Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I got a game called Phase Rip the other day. It's basically the old Marvel Super Heroes game stripped out of all the trade dress and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Because you can't copyright game mechanics. So you could make a game where you roll a D20 and effectively you could just make Dungeons and Dragons again, and people have multiple times. So they did that with the MSH game. I mean, it doesn't say that anywhere in it. They don't even once mention the game, but it's the exact same system with fighting, agility, strength, endurance, reason, intuition, psyche, that whole thing. The whole system of ranks, you know, starting like a very small and then going up. They use different names, but it's the exact same. Anyway, because I have that, I now have a whole list of new adjectives to call you the next time we do our podcast.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. And that means I might have to actually invest in it myself.
It's free.
Well, then I have to invest my time.
Yeah. It's straight up free. A friend of mine pointed it out to me. I went and got it off of a Roll20. It's up for nothing. I'm actually seriously considering using it if we do a Supers game, because it's one of my favorite game systems, although it is a little complex, so I'm on the fence about it.
Well, you know what's also complex? Sometimes we get some very complicated questions from some of our listeners out there.
And, no, let's keep talking about role-playing games.
But we do love when you guys send us questions, so if you have questions for this podcast or the other podcast or even for the queue, you can always send them to us. We do have Discord channels set aside specifically for it, one for patrons. And then one for general use. We always check the patrons one first, and then everywhere else. And then if you want to as well, you could also email us at podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Our first question comes from Zunam, a Death Knight of Nessingray. I can never pronounce that for whatever reason. My brain just doesn't like it. Question for Lorewatch. Are the Nerubians connected to Yogg-Saron the way the Karaji are connected to C'Thun? If they are, and given that we have undead Nerubians, could that mean that other old god minions could be raised as undead? If not, could you speak to where they come from?
Yes. Do you want me to go?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. The Nerubians are kind of like the Karaji and kind of not, in that both the let's put it this way: the Nerubians, the Karaji, and the Mantid all come from the Akir. The Akir are born from an old god. We don't know which one. In fact, they may have been a mixed group from all the old gods. We don't know the answer to that question. But when the Akir went to war with the trolls essentially, after getting a hard time of it for a while, if you've done Zandalar, you've seen places that are like named after various other troll nations. I believe there's, for instance, I think there's like a Zob, and I can't remember the name of the first one, but there's one inside the Nazmir, not Nazmir, no, the desert one, Voldoon. There's like a very, there's an old place that used to be one of the tribes used to live there that later became, I think, the Amani. I think it's Azatanan is the name of it. But when the Zandalar realized they weren't winning the war, they basically unleashed the groups of expansionist trolls that wanted their own places, said, go ahead, go do what you want, fight the way you want to. And what happened was that the Gurubashi, the ancestors of the modern Gurubashi, drove the ancestors of the Mantid and the Karaji into hiding from them, while the Amani drove the ancestors of the Frost Trolls and the Nerubians, not the ancestors of Frost Trolls, sorry, the ancestors of Frost Trolls were part of the group that did this. They drove the Nerubians away. In both cases, the ancestors of the Nerubians and the ancestors of the Karaji, who were still both Akir at the time, found a Titan facility. Inside the Titan facility that the ancestors of the Karaji found was C'Thun. And he seized control of them. Essentially, they didn't have anybody to... They were isolated. They had originally been led by a Chithraxi named Kithix. And when he was gone, they didn't have a leader. So slumbering C'Thun essentially grabbed hold of them and remade them in his image. The Nerubians wiped out the... oh, bloody heck. The Obsidian Destroyers. The Tolvir. There were Tolvir up north, by the way. If you didn't know that, there were Tolvir up in Northrend at the time. They wiped them out. But while they did it, they didn't contact Yogg-Saron at all. In fact, they rebelled against the old gods. They were like, no, you just use us as troops. We're nothing to you, and we don't want to be nothing to you anymore. We don't want to be ruled and controlled by you. So the Nerubians, I don't know if you remember this, when you went to the various Nerubian dungeons in Wrath, the Nerubians were opposed to both the Scourge and the old gods.
Yep.
And the reason for that is because they rebelled against them. So no, they have the exact opposite relationship to Yogg-Saron that the Karaji have to C'Thun and the Mantid have to Shraj. They have, they're antagonistic to them. There are some that have gone back into the worship of the old gods just out of sheer panic because the Scourge was wiping them out. But in general, the Nerubians set up an empire that was completely secular. They didn't worship the old gods. They didn't serve the old gods. They were, in fact, they were afraid of the old gods to the point that when Arthas is taking, I can't remember anybody's names today. The king.
Anubarak?
The traitor king. Yeah, thank you. Anubarak. Is it Anubarak or the other one?
Anubarak is the king.
It's Anubarak is the one. When Arthas and Anubarak were going through the underground Nerubian tunnels to get to the Frozen Throne as fast as possible, they ran into a quote-unquote faceless one. And if you look at the map and you look at the Warcraft 3 mission, it looks very much like they're running into an old god minion, possibly an old god itself. So it could have been some pseudopod of Yogg. We don't know what it was, but when they see it, Anubarak is like, kill it! He's like, he freaks out. He doesn't want anything to do with that. The Nerubians are opposed to the old gods. Now, is that why Nerubians can be turned into undead and we haven't seen any undead Karaji and undead Mantid? Maybe. Maybe it just hasn't been done. I mean, the Scourge was up north. The Scourge wasn't in the places that the Mantid and the Karaji were. So it's quite possible that there's no Scourge because there's no undead members of those species because there just was no effort made to make them undead. The Nerubians were resistant at first, by the way. They had to, the Lich King had to apply himself to turning them. So it's quite possible that they're all resistant.
Well, that was the War of the Spider, right?
Yeah, the War of the Spider. It took them some time. They couldn't just start killing them and raising them as undead immediately. They had to work on it. He had to come up with a way to do it. In terms, the real similarity between the groups is that you can see Obsidian Destroyers in both the Scourge, because they got them from the Nerubians that they conquered, and you can see Obsidian Destroyers in, say, in Anketet. Not Anketet, Ankaraj.
The
Like Moam. Moam is an Obsidian Destroyer. He's a Tolvir.
Yes.
The Tolvir are directly ancestral to all these guys. They're basically just, if you take the stone versions of Tolvir, the ones who haven't got the Curse of Flesh affecting them, you can turn them into Obsidian Destroyers. And that's what those guys are. So that's why those are together.
The other interesting thing, and I just want to add this real quick, is part of the reason that the Lich King and the Scourge, like his Scourge, had to really work at the Nerubians is because they were actually immune to the Undead Plague, which I think they're the marked as immune to the plague.
They were immune to it. They came up with a way to make them undead anyway, but I don't think it was the plague they used to do it.
No, and so I think I'm just my question.
I want to make sure when you say they're immune to the plague, don't think that means they can't be raised. Can be raised, but they can't be raised. The plague doesn't just go through them and kill them.
Right. Now, the question I have about that is I'm wondering how close it was, because this has never been fully explored, I don't think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but with what we know from, like, Darkshore now, with that whole scenario, and that with the raising of some of those, the Night Elf Wardens into Dark Wardens, I'm wondering if some of that was similar with what happened with the Nerubians, where, yeah, they couldn't infect them with the plague and bring them back, but what if he killed them or they died in whatever battle, and he gave them the option to come back to life and serve and raise them? Because he had access to the Vrykul at that point. He had them.
See,
he was using
them. I'll be up front. I still don't believe that the people that come back from the dead have free will and they've chosen to do it. I do not believe it. The only people who have ever said that are the ones that it's happened to. We've never actually had a character start off as alive, die, and be given their perspective from beginning to end. So that's what Sylvanas tells us. For all that's what they tell us, we don't actually have a perspective character.
I was going off of the fact that we see, like, you know, Night Elves refuse and then we have to fight their spirit. But, you know, that I understand what you're saying. Yeah. But I'm just wondering if that was a factor as well, because they never really explain how they raise
them. It's impossible. Right? You see more of it in Chronicle than anything else. Anubarak talks about it. Anubarak definitely does not give me the perspective of somebody who wanted to be doing this.
True.
That he chose anything. Anubarak is like, I didn't want this. He forced it on me, and now you're forcing it on me again. So, if anything, Anubarak is the opposite and disproves that theory, because Anubarak is somebody who straight up doesn't want to be undead. The first time you see him as an undead, when he confronts his people and they call him the Traitor King, Arthas is like, how do they know that? And Anubarak is like, they're talking about me. And the implication is always that Anubarak did not want this, that this is not what he would have chosen. This was forced on him. And that's one of the reasons why I've never believed it, that suddenly when Sylvanas is doing it, it's a free choice. I don't buy it.
I mean, unless there was the whole Arthas was able to funnel things where he wanted to in the afterlife because of control of the Vrykul. That's a whole other thing. We can, like, for another
topic
later,
we,
but
we don't know that,
as well.
We don't know that the Lich King had the Vrykul yet, and if he had Valkyr or not yet. It's quite possible he didn't. Because when the Lich King fought the War of the Spider, was Ner'zhul, not Arthas.
Mm-hmm.
Arthas wasn't even up there yet. It's quite possible that Arthas discovered them later. We don't know when the Vrykul got brought into Scourge, and we don't know when he started, the Lich King started making Valkyr. Did he make them when he was Ner'zhul, or did he make them after? That's not something we have anything on. We don't know exactly when that happened. There are no Valkyr or Vrykul in Warcraft 3. At least there weren't in the original one. So it's quite possible that they did not join him until after. That's another question. Is it a different means of raising the undead? Did he have to just use raw necromantic power? Did he just have to, like, rip them out of their graves and ignore whatever they wanted?
Or like, force how it like a death work? Knight where Anubarak, like, he is himself, right? He is, has his personality, at least to a certain degree. He's under control, but he's not a mindless undead. To me, it almost comes off very closer to, like, something like one of the Death Knights, one of the original Death Knights, where, like, their soul was crammed back into their body and they still retain a sense of self, but they're under the Lich King's control. So I always sort of equated Anubarak with that.
That's another thing to think about. When you go through the Death Knight starting experience, the original one, you were definitely not asked
No, you weren't. You were just shoved back in your body.
And you don't even remember yourself until you're reminded of who you used to be.
Yeah, in the original Death Knights, that was pretty much how it was done, too, because it was orc souls shoved into a human body, right?
Yeah, but they weren't controlled. They had the jeweled truncheons, and they were willing to do what they were told to do by Gul'dan, because the alternative was non-existence. But they weren't, like, not even in the case of him, like, making them non-exist. He's like, look, you can be dead, you can be this, or you can stay dead. It's up to you. And they went with that, because at least they could still do things. But Terran Gorfiend, I mean, all those guys have nothing to do with the Lich King.
I was more the concept of it, right?
Terran Gorfiend and Ner'zhul worked together after Gul'dan had been destroyed, and it's likely that Terran Gorfiend was the inspiration behind the kind of Death Knight that Ner'zhul would create.
The template, the blueprint for it, almost.
Yeah, because he never would have seen it before that, and then he would have, like, oh, that's what you are. So it's interesting, but going back to the original question as to whether or not they can be raised as undead, the answer is maybe. We don't actually know. They would probably be immune to this, to the Plague of Undeath, just like Worgen are immune to the Plague of Undeath because of their connection to the natural world. They can be made undead. You can raise them as Death Knights, but they're immune to the plague. So you can't just, you know, hit them with, like, disease and they'll pop up as zombies. They're immune to that.
Which,
in a similar way, it's quite possible because, again, the Nerubians and the Karaji and the Mantid are connected to the old gods. They're creations of the old gods, who are themselves blasphemous creatures from the void. So it's quite possible that connection keeps them from being affected by the Plague of Undeath.
But that goes to the second part of the question of whether or not the other ones could be raised as undead. I think that the Nerubians make the case that, yes, you could. It just depends on the method in which they are becoming undead. We know that the plague won't work, but as Matt pointed out, raw necromantic power, yeah, that could probably still work. Whether it's raising them almost as Death Knights, that could also just work. We just haven't seen the other ones yet raised as undead. But I always wondered about that, too, with, like, the Mantids in particular, because they're more... They display more humanoid-like, I don't want to say features, but they tend to walk upright, they tend to have a little more emotion. People tend to, at least in my experience, players tend to connect with them a little bit more. Like, I could see them being raised as, like, elite Death Knights. Like, imagine some of the Swarm Lords and some of the Blade Lords from the actual Heart of Fear being raised as Death Knights to serve in the Lich King's army. I'm actually relatively surprised it hasn't happened yet, or we haven't seen a Bolvar try to do that before he lost the helm.
Well, I mean, let's be fair. Bolvar had plenty of Nerubians, so... He wouldn't need to go get other bug people and undead servants if he wanted them. In terms of the Karaji, there are just as many personalized Karaji. It's just that we only ever got to see them as bosses in a raid.
Very true.
We never spent time as sort of buddies with them the way we did with the Mantid. Granted, it was an alliance of convenience, but we did work with them for a while. So I think, like, it's a little unfair to say the Karaji don't have that kind of thing. The Prophet Skaram comes to mind as one who talked. A lot of them talk to us, tell us, you know, the one that always gets me are the Twin Emperors, who look like giant bug Night Elves. And I've always wondered if, like, did they just copy Night Elves to make them? Like, how that worked? Obviously, the real truth is they just gave them a Night Elf skeleton because it was easy. But, you know, lore has to bend when the game does things.
Of course.
But in terms of all of this, the question is twofold. The one is, can it happen? Signs point to probably. I mean, it feels like if it's alive, it can be made undead if you're willing to pay the price for it. The Scourge makes it super easy to convert vast numbers of people into mindless undead. You don't have to do anything. You just spread it. You poison some grain, and next thing you know, half of the Northlands is full of zombies. Whereas the Lich King having to directly use his massive power to raise you from the dead is a significant investment. Like, each Death Knight isn't a significant investment. It's not the same as, here, look, I've got an entire army of undead and all I had to do was poison some grain, versus I had to go out and directly use my vast power to rip you out of the place you're supposed to be and to shackle your spirit into your body. And definitely in both the case of the Scourge and in the case of the Lich King, there's no such thing as choice here.
Mm-hmm.
The Lich King does not ask.
Nope, it just happens.
Yeah. So, in general, I think the answer to both of these questions, we've answered the question about the Nerubians in terms of where they come from, and if the Karaji and the Mantid are both related to the Nerubians, they are all descended from the Aegir. How they descended differently depends on where they ended up after the trolls had essentially broken their own empire to smash the Aegir. They literally, the Zandalari accepted obsolescence and fragmentation as the price to win the war. And they unleashed the Amani and Gurubaji on the world and caused a troll diaspora, which led to like trolls living all over the world in different tribes. Before that war, the Zandalari were effectively in control of every troll. And the price of beating the Aegir was losing that control, because they couldn't successfully prosecute the war by themselves. They couldn't run it by themselves. And once the Amani and Gurubashi had tasted freedom, there wasn't any going back. It's not like the Zandalari couldn't afford to then attempt to reconquer their own people. And so they just were like, okay, you want to lead up there, that's fine. We're going to keep Zandalar Mountain, but if you want the rest, fine, we don't care. And they decided to be culturally important, which is rare for power to do that. But maybe they understood what was going to happen next, because what happened next was the Night Elves came into being and just kicked the living crap out of both the Amani and the Gurubashi until they whimpered off into their little holes. And that war could not have happened without the trolls spending a great deal of their power stopping the Aegir,
mm-hmm.
and causing the three different kinds of I don't know what you'd call them, insectoids?
Yeah, I think that works.
It's not really fair, because the Nerubians are clearly arachnoid, but whatever. Those three different kinds of people all come out of that war. And they should, if one is affected by undeath in some fashion, if you can raise them, then you should be able to raise the others.
Yeah. So I think that thoroughly answers that question. We're going to move on to our next one, which is from my-a. As we look at all of the classes and how some of the newer class-race combinations came about, I'm looking at you, Sunwalkers, what other combinations do you guys see being possible? For example, seeing how the Kul'tiran druids use creepy drust magic to be druids, couldn't the Forsaken do something similar? I feel like it'd make even more sense post-Shadowlands, especially if we end up in a patch that sends us to Thras, or teaches us more about the drust. Not that I need any more alts, but I totally roll a bony bear or carcass kitty. I mean, there's a... I don't know how many options
I am
there
straight
are
up.
That.
I'll just say straight up. I think they should just have every class playable by every race. That's where I am on this. I think we are way past the point of race class. The fact that we have... Forsaken might as well be druids. Not only do we have the Drust tradition, mm-hmm. of like, you know, death as a part of the balance, but we've got two different kinds of human who can be druids now. Out of the, you know, it's like Forsaken are all dead humans. Why not? We've got the wolf humans. I think I described it once was original recipe, extra beefy and wolfy. Technically, Forsaken are deady. You know what I'm saying?
They're the lean option.
No, they're not lean. They're like, you know, jerked, if you want to get like that about it. They're like, you know, sun-dried, plague-kissed. I don't know what word you want to use, but the point being, they're effectively dead people. And if you've got a kind of druidism that touches on death as part of the balance, then yeah, why not?
We've talked about this a lot in the past, and we've had a lot of previous episodes where we've come up with the merits of it, but I'm with Matt on this one, and I think there's justifications to be had for any race class combination. We've talked about, like, Night Elf Shaman. They are absolutely a thing that I could see happening, or Blood Elf Shaman in general. Like, why not? Those are things that make sense lore-wise. Maybe you have a Draenei who, you know, focuses on the light to form their, you know, druidic forms. The light is part of nature. The light touches everything. The light feeds into that cycle. Why wouldn't there be a connection there? Why couldn't there be a connection there?
I mean, for that matter, I mean, Blizzard themselves teases stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah.
If you went through the Paladin Order Hall, you saw the Night Elf Paladin.
Yep, there was a Night Elf Paladin there.
So why not? If we're going to have Night Elf Paladins in lore, let's have them in game. There's just a lot of this stuff that I feel like we've gone past the point where it even makes sense lore-wise. The thing is that if you have you want to have organizations that are unique to specific races, I get it. But the past however long, it's been 16 years we've been playing World of Warcraft. In that time, all these groups have been bumping into each other. They've
working
had
together.
Order halls. Yeah, it just it beggars, and the restrictions are strange. Like the idea that you can't have a Draenei warlock when the Eredar are the most famous and powerful warlocks in existence, and they're Draenei, or more accurately, the Draenei are them.
And especially now with like the Legion on the back, like the back foot, so to speak. And like, I'm not going to say they're defeated, but we push them back. So the lore-ish reasons of, oh, the corruption of Sargeras, the corruption of Archimonde and Kil'jaeden and blah, blah, like that's not as much of a factor now. Like we've gotten rid of some of that, that this is why they don't do it. Maybe now they could. But it makes a lot of this makes perfect sense to allow like. Something that's always bothered me is we've had how many wars at this point that we've actively participated in game? At least a couple.
I think we're up to four.
Yeah, I think we're up to four. So what happens during those times? This is something that like my grandfather told me about when I was a younger kid, is that when you're in the foxhole with somebody next to you, even if you don't know them or they're from somewhere that you're not from, you learn, you understand things, you talk about things because that's what you do. Or if you're like up at night on patrol or on lookout, you talk to each other, you learn about each other. You don't have another choice. It's not like you can whip out a television or a newspaper and just kind of like go about your day, because that's not generally how these things worked, and that's not how they work here. Like in World of Warcraft, like when you're in war and you're bunkered down, you're with different races, you're with different classes, you're gonna talk. There's going to be conversation, even if you like canonically hate that class. Like if you know we can go with the fantasy racism or whatever, but you're going to talk even then at that point, and you're going to learn something, and maybe that sparks something. And the fact that that hasn't happened really in any large scale bothers me.
Well, plus, I mean, there's something else that's not even related to that, which is valid. I'm not disputing anything you just said. But there's also the fact... Sorry, I had to cough there. When you are at war with something, you study how they fight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. The idea that the Eredar are the master warlocks of the universe, even if you don't want to be a warlock yourself, you are going to learn about how the warlock magic works in order to oppose it. And that means there's somebody in Draenei society who is an expert at warlock magic and who could effectively be a warlock. Even if he doesn't, he still know this is how we get atom bombs. You know, knowledge from multiple sources is combined and you eventually make a weapon out of it, because that's what happens in wars. You try to make the best new super weapon you can. The Horde has been making super weapons for like three war chiefs now.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to tell me at no point did any Forsaken think, hey, there's that undead guy in the next Ramas who can use the Holy Light. We should get in on that.
Or the mages, human mages going, you know, they did this against us. Maybe we could do this against them. Like,
there's no justification at this point for like certain classes being as rare as they are. Druid magic really comes to mind. At this point, there's just no reason.
Shaman are up there,
too. Shaman, I'm not as upset with shaman for the simple fact that shaman are supposed to be the kind of thing that certain groups look down on. And I'm okay with that, because that's a cultural bias that I can see. But I'm at the point where I think even that's dumb. Like, at this point, you've seen this guy convince a giant elemental to freaking come up out of the ground and punch you in the face 16 times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How do we get him to not do that? Or how do I make my own so that one that's punching... Oh, he's got a big punchy one. I'm going to make this fire one. we're at the point where it's just I've been playing too many modern role playing games. And I played Divinity Original Sin, where every class was open to every race. And any D&D based game, every class is open to every
race.
Even
now, yeah, like in people that argue that D&D used to be restrictive, the key word there is used to be, not anymore.
Yeah, and it hasn't been for like two editions now.
Easily.
You know? So I feel like the time has come for this to just be a thing. If you want to say it's rare, fine, it's rare. My character and the other 35 who are going to roll it, because of course they are. But my, you know, fine. The player character is the only one who's really doing it. Well, but nevertheless,
the lore doesn't have to fit the player base, right? The lore just has to fit the world. So the lore could be whatever. They could say, like you said, that they could be rare, and there could be 1,000 players running around as that particular class race combination. That doesn't change the story, right? Like, we've already experienced that how many times and how many class specific stories. The Shaman Order Hall was all about that, and yet how many Shaman players are there in the game? So, like, they can't even hide behind that anymore, because the player base doesn't have to inform the lore, or vice versa. Just make it available, and then the rarity is the story, and that's fine. So,
and there is, if you want to have lore justifications, though, they're there for everything.
Oh, yeah, you can.
If you could put in a Tauren who's like, hey, we've discovered the sun, and now we're going to have priests and paladins, then you could put in a night elf. You could put in a blood elf who's like, hey, remember how our ancestors used to use magic to control plants? I figured that out. So, yeah, I'm going to teach you how to be a druid now. And you could totally have a night elf who's like, Alun has decided to empower my blade. Boom, paladins. It doesn't take a lot of effort. This could be done for everything.
And I think Shadowlands is a really good opportunity to do that if they really wanted to, simply because we're going to places where a lot of cross-pollinization could be a thing. A lot of understanding and learning can happen. Like, you're talking about druids. You go to Ardenweald, you're a night elf. Whoa, what's going on here? Ardenweald seems very druidy to me. Like, why couldn't they teach them other things? Why couldn't they teach them, you know, there could be things to justify it in-game coming up pretty easily. But let's move on to the next one, which is from Metal Zani. Question for Lore Watch. Howdy, Watchers. After listening to you talk about the Lich King the last episode, I had a thought and started connecting the red string on my corkboard. I believe it was Uther to first say there must always be a Lich King in the Hall of Reflection dungeon. And then at the end of the raid, where this is spoken again, then Bolvar calls himself the Jailer of the Damned. Fast forward to BFA, there's a quest to go visit him for Vol'jin called Jailer of the Damned, and now we have Torghast, Tower of the Damned. Am I wrong in thinking that the Lich King seemed more like a metaphorical lock to keeping something sealed, and that's why the Dark Lady broke his helm to unlock her new buddies in the Shadowlands? Sorry for the wrong rant. Keep being excellent at what you do. Again, we don't know what the purpose of the Helm of Domination was beyond controlling the Scourge, but or where its origin are, but this is something we're absolutely going to learn about. They've said as much. We're going to the Forge that created this, and I believe Frostmourne as well. We're going there. We're going to figure out what happened. I've been positing since the very beginning that this was a soul-linked item that maybe didn't go quite as planned with the entity that was soul-linked with it, possibly the Jailer. And I think that maybe there's something here where the helm was drawing from that power, maybe not necessarily as a lock, but keeping the Jailer in Torghast from being full power and being whatever it wanted to do. So I think there is something here where the helm is instrumental in that, but I'm not sure that it was necessarily just a lock. I think it was more than that. What do you think?
Well, I mean, people use the word lock to mean a lot of things.
Sure.
And a lot of times people, when they think lock, they think key. But how do you get, let's say you live in like you live on the Atlantic Ocean and you want to get to the Pacific Ocean. You can go the long way around. Mm-hmm. You can sail entirely around South America. But say you don't want to take that much time. And while it'll take more time in the short run, once you've dug a canal.
Yep.
In the long run, it will save tons and tons of time. People will be able to just go straight through. However, because of things like elevation, you can't just blast through a continent. Even a small isthmus of land between two continents is a significant amount of land to shift.
Which is why they created lock systems.
They have lock systems. So you go up and down a level in order to get to the place you're trying to go. It's quite possible that the entirety of the Helm of Domination acts as a means to effectively raise and lower the amount of the Shadowlands that comes through into our world. Right now, it's been destroyed, which would be like dynamiting a canal and blowing open all the locks. You do that, and the canal just literally streams through. You've got no regulation at all. And that's problematic if you want to maintain normal things. You want to get people up and down in a normal way. But the shortcut still exists, and that's what that giant hole over Northrend is going to be. That's one possibility, one metaphor to look at it. The thing is that none of this is established yet. As Joe said, we don't know the answers. But also, we're looking at it. We often look at things in a binary way.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be a binary way. Like, it isn't just that there's a hole open that allows the Shadowlands into our world. That hole also allows our world into the Shadowlands. It's quite possible that a lot of the problems happening in the Shadowlands right now are because of too much of our world. Our world behaves differently. It has different rules. It has different laws of nature. It has laws of nature. Other planes of existence affect it. Shadowlands is not directly affected by other planes of existence usually. Now suddenly it is. By one plane of existence that is touched by lots of other planes of existence. It's quite possible the Helm of Domination was created to keep the Shadowlands pure. To keep us isolated. To keep traffic to go into one direction.
Or
things are supposed to go from our world to the Shadowlands. Not from the Shadowlands to our world. And if the Shadowlands wanted to keep the flow regulated so that stuff comes in, stuff goes out, now suddenly that's not the case anymore. It's not regulated.
That makes a really good point, because now I'm starting to think about the whole world soul and spirit situation and wondering if maybe that's what happened all that long ago. Because what do we've learned about on Draenor, where there was no world soul consuming the spirit and spirit ran rampant. We had the overgrowth. We had all of that happening, and then that created that whole situation there. But on Azeroth, that's not the case. Because we have a world soul, because we have Titan facilities that are being used to funnel spirit back into the planet itself, at least a little bit, that world soul, we've had a ton of weird situations, like the whole elemental thing and everything else, and wondering if the Helm of Domination plays into it, like you're saying, where that was the only way to keep the Shadowlands from getting any spirit, or to allow them to get any spirit, to have that flow, like you're saying, to keep that spirit from being consumed, that anima from being consumed by the world soul who, you know, would have sucked it in. So that is a very interesting point, and I'm wondering if that might be part of it as well. I like that. Anything else to add on that one?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. All right, our next one comes from Ghost over on Airy Peak. I came back to WoW at the end of Warlords and didn't fully level through all of the leveling zones in a rush to get to raiding. I have two questions from Warlords of Draenor. What happened to the alternate Draenor Ogryn? Does he not exist? And two, is there a story in the Tanaan Jungle or in a Grand Quest to explain how Grommash went from being a bad guy that ran the Iron Horde and wanted to invade Azeroth and take over into someone that we're cool with joining us to fight Archimonde?
Okay, you want to do these or you want me to?
Go for it.
Okay, we do know that Orgrim existed. We see him. If you're Horde side, you're given a series of quests to try and contact him, because you remember you're working with that world's version of Durotar?
Yep.
Durotar's the place. while you're working with that world's version of Durotan, he tries to contact his old buddy Orgrim, who is working for the Iron Horde. And it doesn't really work out. He's not willing to betray the Iron Horde, so you can't really... He doesn't join you, but he's there. You see him. I think he eventually does kind of oppose Black Hand, but I don't remember. I've not done these quests in a long time.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll fill in on that one then. It was during the Battle of Shattrath in Warlords of Draenor that Doomhammer and Black Hand actually fight. Ogryn Doomhammer says he will not kill innocents, and he accuses of Black Hand making Draenor burn. And then basically he gets named a traitor and is just killed flat out by Black Hand, which really stresses Durotan out. But that's what happens, why we don't really see him too much, is he when he finally shows up, and he was the second in command. I think it was the group he led, but he was second in command under Black Hand. But when he wouldn't kill innocents, he was straight up murdered. And that the Battle for Shattrath happened pretty early as far as Warlords of Draenor is concerned. So that's why you don't see him. That's why he existed. He just died.
Yeah. And in terms of why Grom goes from the box art guy to, you know, our friend, in quotes, if I played Alliance, he was never my friend. Basically, if you get to a certain point just before the opening of Tanan, there's a quest chain that leads to you battling, I can't remember her name, but Azula Blade Fury.
Mm-hmm.
You end up fighting her, and you end up driving the Iron Horde back into Tanan jungle. You drive them out of where you're fighting them in, I believe it's actually the same zone as the Battle of Shattrath. I believe it's that area. I want to say Talar, but I can't remember what they called the zone.
Yeah, I think it was either Talar or Taladar. I can't remember.
Yeah, but you push them back, and they're like, you know, we'll be back. But then there's like a cutscene, and when they watch the cutscene, effectively Gul'dan shows up again, and they're like, you know, get out of here. And he's like, you know, he offers Grom the chance to drink one last time, and he's like, no, I won't. And he goes, really? Not even after your son is dead? And he throws the two-handed axe Gorhel at his feet. And Grom is like, my son? Because Grommash never told...
Garrosh
never told Grommash that he was his son. He never said, I'm your son from another world or anything like that. So this was the first... In this world, his wife died before she could bear him a son. Gorka died first.
Well, yeah, and he helped facilitate that a little bit too. Don't forget, he called her a wolf without teeth and walked away and left her to die.
Yeah, but nevertheless, she died before she could bear him a son in this world. So, as a result, he had no concept that, you know, Garrosh was his son. He just knew that he was this powerful warrior from another world who, you know, told him, you know, don't drink the blood, it's bad. So he's all stunned and he's not reacting at first, but then he's like, no, I won't drink it. I won't take the deal. And Gul'dan turns and goes, what about you? And it's oh, bloody heck, eyeball guy. I'm having a real hard time with names today.
Kilrog.
Yeah, it's Kilrog who's like, all right, I'll take the deal. And Gul'dan basically uses fell magic to pin a Grom to a wall while Kilrog takes the deal and starts drinking the blood and turns into a fell orc. And that's how the orcs we see in the Fel Horde come out of that. They're members of the Iron Horde that take the deal after Kilrog deposes Grom. And that's why Grom is our quote-unquote friend, because he's an ally. He hates the Fel Horde. He hates Gul'dan.
Oh, he hates Gul'dan, yeah.
Yeah, and he absolutely hates the demons who want to enslave his people. And as a result, when you do the raid, there's a fight that is basically just a big demon lord who's got a really cool-looking axe. And I know this because I have farmed that guy in every difficulty. I've got all three of them. And when you kill him, you know, Grom drops out of his shackles and is like, yeah, I'll see you at the final fight. I just have to have some time cutting some trophies off of this guy, just, you know, because he upset me with all that torturing thing. So that's why he's on our side. It's not that he suddenly became a good guy. It's just that he hates the Fel and the demons as much as we do.
And the whole we saved him thing helps a little bit. Because we did.
Yeah, it's true. We did save him.
It's almost like an indebted honor thing for him at that point, too. And I think he comments on that as well.
But at any rate, it's definitely a case where he has motivation. The things he did up front, by the way, the reason he decides to conquer our world in the first place is because Garrosh very deliberately doesn't show Grom all of the alternate world's history.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't show him Thrall saving that Grom from the demons. He doesn't show any of Thrall's role in it. He doesn't show the repentance. So this Grom goes into it thinking, oh, the alternate version of me just failed and drank the demon blood and was a monster. I have to not be that. He never once saw his own redemption. He didn't see Thrall's role in it. None of that. So he was shown some of our history, but not all of it. That's also, by the way, if you ever people wondering what happened to the, you know, Grom's son from that timeline when the Maghar joined the Horde, the reason that no one calls that guy Garrosh is because he probably wasn't named Garrosh.
Mm-hmm.
And he almost certainly he had a different mother because Garrosh's mother died in that timeline without ever having a child. It's much the same thing as Nirzul's wife is still alive on that world when she died before the events of the Legion showing up in our timeline. On that world, she's still alive. There are differences between the warlords of Draenor, and our Draenor. There are a few of them. They're pretty significant ones too. That people who die, people are alive who died. People died who were alive. I think that at one point it's even commented on a story. It's like blades of grass. Some of the blades are different. The grass looks the same, but if you get down and actually start looking at the blades, you start noticing differences. That's the way that Draenor differs, and it's quite possible, for instance, that the story of that Gul'dan is not the same as our Gul'dan. If you watch the story that they put out, the short for the Gul'dan from that world, it is not necessarily the same as what happened in our world with our Gul'dan. So that's something to keep in mind.
Our next question, greetings, watchers. Enjoying the weekly episodes with both Matt and Joe while still missing Anne. Yeah, we miss Anne too. Hope she's enjoying her current occupation at Blizzard HQ. I am very sorry if my question has already been answered before, but please allow me to ask regarding the Night Elves. If my understanding is correct, Night Elves were descended from Dark Trolls, which both High Elves, Blood Elves, / Void Elves, and Nightborn were descended from Night Elves. My question is, at which point do the Night Elves gain the transition to Wisp when they die? Because my understanding, please feel free to correct me if I am wrong, for both High Elves, Blood Elves, / Void Elves, and Nightborn, when they die, they do not turn to Wisps, I think. Is there any existing explanation for this? Maybe during the Blessing of the Dragon aspects, ? I also do not know if all Night Elves turn into Wisps after they die. If so, then, during the burning of Teldrassil, all Night Elves that burn should have returned as Wisps, ? The process is a little bit confusing to me. Night Elves die, turn to Wisp, then Wisp dies, go to Shadowlands? Apologies if the question is so simple, but since Shadowlands has been announced, I got curious about the matter. This is from Aramis, a human paladin on Airy Peak. I don't know. Do we ever explain the Wisp process in game?
I mean, there is no explanation. That's what happens when they die. They don't. There's no point where anyone says, you know, why do we not have ghosts? Why do we have Wisps instead? The reason is that we first see the Wisps in Warcraft 3, and they're hanging around a forest, and they basically come when they're called by Malfurion. He blows the horn and summons them.
From the Grove of Asenia, right?
Yeah, Asenia. And they attack. Oh God, Archimonde. There we go. I actually remembered the name today. They attack Archimonde and basically infuse him with so much power that he explodes. And the implication is that when Night Elves die, because they are so bound to nature, that they just inhabit it after they're dead in Wisp form. But it's never specifically stated why Night Elves have this and others don't. Why don't, for instance, we don't know what happens when Dark Trolls die, because as far as we can tell, all the Dark Trolls are dead. If they're not all dead, then they're hiding. We don't have any real knowledge. Supposedly, the last Dark Trolls died during just before Cataclysm. The Twilight Hammer killed them when they were getting ready to attack Hyjal. We don't know, but we've never seen one. We don't know how they work. They actually appear in Warcraft 3, I think.
Yeah, they're the basic building unit of Warcraft 3, which is when they were transitioned over into as far as like World of Warcraft goes. They were essentially Night Elf peons back then. They're one of those weird things where a lot of their lore and history has been retrofitted over the years to really fit what the current model is as far as the game world goes. There's a low-level quest I remember from the Alliance side. I think it was after Cataclysm. It was the Ruins of Aberdeen. You basically go there and you're coaxing the spirits out of the dead bodies to become wisps. Like, this process is something you're helping them accomplish. And it's not the only time. Like, we know that the Horn of Cenarius is what Matt was talking about before. When that was blown, that they all showed up during the Third War, during the final battle. And we saw that during the Mount Hyjal raid as well. That was part of that whole final sequence. But also during the Burning Legion, during Legion, when we had all the artifacts, we had that branch of the Khanir, the Mother Tree, and that was capable of summoning them as well. We don't know if that was just like waking up the dead or pulling them out, but in every aspect, whenever they're being called, they're always emerging from, like Matt said, nature. They're always emerging from the trees that they helped inhabit or that they were so connected to. And then I think the last time we saw them this expansion in Battle for Azeroth was during the War of the Thorns, where Malfurion summons a whole wall of them to essentially cut off the Horde, or at least slow them down.
There's actually one Dark Troll alive that we know of. And she's a Dark Troll of the Shadowtooth Clan. She's in the House of the Fallen Tribes at the Terrace of the Speakers in Dazar'a Lore. And when you talk to her, she says something to the effect of, "You never heard of the Shadowtooth Clan? No surprise, the tribe be wiped out by the Twilight's Hammer. The Zandalari be keeping one representative as a memento of the past. Now I be nothing more than a curiosity. It not so bad. I never have to buy any of my own drinks." So that's the one that we know of. And she's a female Dark Troll. She's in the Dazar'a lore, as I said. She just looks like a troll. There's nothing specifically about her that... You look at her, you don't say, "Ooh, that looks like a night elf," except her skin's kind of a blue color and her hair's kind of green. So at least I'm looking at it and it kind of looks green in this picture, but it might be a darker blue for that matter. I keep mine blood in my eye, so I have trouble with certain things. But yeah, there's one left alive. The rest we don't see. The Shadowtooth are the only ones we've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones we saw in Warcraft 3. They aided the Night Elves, the Alliance, and the Horde at the Battle of Mount Hyjal. That's the only time we ever saw them. And that's the only one left is Speaker Iqnal, who says they were wiped out by the Twilight's Hammer during the Khal's attack on Hyjal. So, yeah, as of right now, there's one Dark Troll left. If there are any others, we don't know about them.
And whether or not they could be coaxed out as wisps, we don't know. We can't know now. Yeah.
But in terms of like where Wisp spirit seems to be come from, as the Night Elves got a stronger connection to nature, I don't recall if, for instance, the War of the Ancients, I don't recall if those novels mentioned it or not.
I don't think they did.
I certainly don't know of anything. But Wisp spirits are generally treated as Loa by trolls. And they're obviously treated as revered ancestors by the Night Elves. In terms of like, you know, do they go first to the Shadowlands and then come back in Wisp form out of Ardenweald? I don't have an answer to that question. I don't know how it works. And in terms of, I think in general terms, however, the reason that other Elf tribes don't have Wisps is that they've turned their backs on the Night Elf connection to nature.
I think so too.
If you look at the Blood Elves and the High Elves before them, they shaped nature in Quel'Thalas to fit what they wanted it to be aesthetically. They didn't live in peace with it. They made it be what they wanted. They didn't emulate it and they didn't worship it. It was a tool and it was something that did what they wanted. Void Elves, obviously, even further down that road. And the Nightborn took the Highborn thing and went way wild with it. They isolated themselves in a bubble. Their idea of nature was a zoo that they kept some animals in. And their tradition of the Arcano, you know, the Arcana trees and so forth, was very definitely not Druidic. Maybe it could be considered a cousin to Druidism, but they definitely moved further away from nature as well. So that's probably why they don't have wisp forms, because they're not in tune with nature the way that night elves are. And physically, they're all changed too, although the Nightborn are the closest. The Nightborn still look mostly like night elves, at least. They still have the skin tones and ears. They're pretty similar. But in general, all the other elves are pretty different.
Also, I'm kind of curious with the Nightborn, too, if that's an option for them, since now we did everything with the Arkandor.
Arkandor really doesn't feel natural in the slightest.
But it was it was a druid that helped make that thing a thing. So I'm wondering if there's a melding there.
He wasn't really a druid. There's a whole thing about whether or not that guy's a druid. We've gotten into arguments with that before, so I don't think we need to again, but there's a lot to that guy's story that implies he's not a druid.
Fair. I think we have time.
At any rate, we don't really know one way or the other.
And I think we have time for one more. So, hi, Joe and Matt. Reflecting on Matt's often well-versed summary of the history of the Human Kingdoms, and taking into account your past discussion about your desire for future WoW expansions to address the neglected consequences remaining from the major story arcs, my question to you both is in regard to the now derelict Human Kingdom of Alterac. With the Forsaken retreat from Lordaeron during BFA, and the canonical victory of the Alliance in retaking Stormguard, and presumably restoring the Trollbane rule, I am left to wonder if Alterac would also be restored under Alliance rule as well, given the strategic advantage from these circumstances. Assuming this is true, please speculate how Alterac could be restored, or the likelihood of Alterac being merged into Stormguard, or how the remnants of the Horde is able to continue to hold on to the ruins of Alterac. Thanks as always for the great show. To Darian, Void Elf, Discipline Priest from Bronzebeard. Go for it. I know you got a lot to say on this one.
Well, up front, Perrinold's gone. The Perrinold family, the ones that ruled Alterac, and King Aiden Perrinold betrayed them during the Second War and allowed the Horde to pass through Alterac in exchange for a promise from them that they wouldn't harm Alterac or its people. He just straight up, he just straight up made a deal with them. When they found out, the Alliance was so mad that they smashed Alterac. They just destroyed it. There's nothing. It's very hard to say there's anything even left. So today, there's no Alterac really. There's some ruins. There's some cottages and stuff. It's not like there's this. The nation does not exist. The lands are gone, and the position of ruler of Alterac is gone. Like, both, there's been like two people who've like from the Perrinold dynasty who've claimed it. I think they're both dead now.
Mm-hmm.
Aladin Perrinold, he was the last living member of the last member of the family, and he was the leader of the syndicate, and I'm pretty sure he died.
There's Isidin and Gilneas, but we don't know what happened to them.
Isidin Perrinold, yeah, he fled to Gilneas, but he got backed by Ghen Greymane, but he didn't really get to do anything. Like, as far as we know, we don't even know if he's alive.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. We don't know if he's even around still.
There's actually a Warcraft 3 Death Knight hero unit named Baron Perrinold. So that might be Isildin. But it's like he does not show up. Like, we have not seen him in some time. And as for the third guy who claimed to be related to them, his name was Dival Prester. And he was a big dragon. He was Deathwing. So unless Deathwing comes back, I don't think he's going to be making any claims. I think as of right now, it's like, I don't know what Blizzard's planning on doing with the whole Forsaken story. I've played more Night Elves, so I tend to focus on the Night Elf story and so forth. But if you're Forsaken, you're in a really weird place right now. Your ruler since World of Warcraft started, since Warcraft 3 really, was Sylvanas Windrunner. She's now not leading the Forsaken. She's effectively abandoned them. That leaves you in a place where we don't even know for sure who's going to end up leader. It certainly looks like it's going to be Kalia Menethil. Like, the game has been making a lot of strides towards Calumenithil.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly with the help of, like, other figures, including, oh, bloody heck, I can't remember her name. My God, I'm having trouble with names today. The one that's the undead girl who's
Lillian
like
Voss.
A spy. Thank you, Lillian Voss.
Mm-hmm.
Lillian Voss seems to be involved in some fashion. So that looks to be what's going to happen, but I can't say for sure. You know, we haven't actually gotten there yet. But if you look at it, the Forsaken have lost, like, their entire starting zone. Just like the Night Elves did. It's gone. Like, they don't have any of it. And it's very unlikely. Like, people have, like, said, well, you think they went over to, like, where did they go? Like, where, like, they couldn't all have been evacuated. Are there any, like, did they move over to the Plague Lands? And that's certainly possible. We were talking about this, I think it was last week, weren't we?
I think so.
I'm drawing a blank on the city in question, because it's the one that Sylvanas originally claimed. Originally Chromie was there.
Goodness.
Yeah, it's really bad today for me in terms of remembering names. But that zone, that area, that city, that could be one place the undead went. They absolutely could very well go to Alterac, because there's nothing there. There's an ogre infested ruin. It would be the work of a couple of hours for them to clear that out. And they could use the ruins of Alterac. They could set up shop there. But we don't even know, like, right now, I don't even know what the status of Taran Mill is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do the Forsaken still have Taran Mill? Like, remember, they killed everybody in South Shore. They completely took over that zone. Do they still hold it? Do they have those farms in that area? How much of the, you know, with the Alliance having taken pretty much, canonically, the Alliance has taken over the entirety of Stromgarde and that zone. The Horde, does the Horde still have Hammerfall? If they do, do they still have Taran Mill? Like, they would effectively be surrounding the Alliance there. Like, there's a lot, too. We don't know. We have no idea what's going on. So, there's really no feasible way you could put somebody on the throne in Alterac, because there's just nothing there. You could claim Alterac. You absolutely could. But it's kind of like you'd have to basically recolonize it, I think is what I'm trying to get at. You'd have to basically clear out the ruins. You'd have to set it up. I think either faction has an equal chance of being able to do that. In some ways, the Forsaken and the Horde would have a better shot at it, because they'd have support from coming down from Quel'Thalas. They'd have Hammerfall as a possible base. They'd have Reventusk if you want to head all the way over. They've got bases in the area. The Alliance, however, probably wants to reclaim Silverpine, and they want to reclaim Gilneas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they'd go for Alterac first.
I don't think so either.
I figure that their option is, now that they have Stromgarde, they'd probably try to set up some kind of supplying base on the way to Gilneas, and then just claim Gilneas and then push up from there. That seems to me the more likely option, rather than going to Alterac, a place which is, you know, synonymous with treachery and which has no real strategic value anymore, because there's nothing there. It's not like the ruins of Alterac command the pass anymore. It's not like when the Second War, where the Horde used Alterac as a way to sneak into Lordaeron. No one's going to be doing that right now.
Oh,
so,
by the way, the city we couldn't think of, I just remembered, it's Anderol.
Anderol, thank you.
Yep.
I couldn't get that in my head. but yeah, I think in general, the entire area feels like it's up in play. And if you're like playing a Forsaken right now, I feel like they kind of need to come up with a way for the Forsaken to reclaim their area, just because if you don't,
they're sort of, like, in the wind.
Yeah. Where are they going to go? Like, are they going to just all live in Orgrimmar forever? Are you going to create a colony for them somewhere? Again, give them Azshara? Like, you know, with the Alliance having won at the Battle of Darkshore, the Horde's in the worst position on both continents that they've ever been in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Alliance is now very firmly encamped in Hyjal, so they're like looking down at you. They've got Darkshore back. They're probably going to push into Ashenvale again, especially since it's the Night Elves, and the Night Elves don't care what peace treaties Anduin signs. They are absolutely unconcerned with them. They are not going to obey them. They're going to try and take back every piece of territory they've ever lost. So you've got that pressure on Kalimdor, and then meanwhile you've got all these Forsaken with no place to go. You know, I feel like they've got to try to reclaim the areas that were theirs originally, which would certainly throw a spanner in the Alliance's plans to take back Ilnaeus, much less claiming some place like Alterac, which is so out of, I don't see it happening.
Yeah, and I agree with everything that Matt said. Like, it's one of those things where I think it would be cool to see some of that, but I mean, I think the last living, or I can't even say living, the last person that can claim any lineage to any of those places is an undead NPC at this point in one of those zones, and that's it. Like, I don't think that it's going to be a higher priority compared to some of the other options. And honestly, like, while I would love it to eventually be dealt with, and I think it would be a very interesting story, the sort of like the reestablishment of those areas, like the Kingdom of Alterac, and sort of like putting that back together, I could see the Alliance trying to do something along that later on, like, especially with everything that's going on with Anduin and the human side of things in general. I could see him wanting to rebuild that at some point and appoint somebody as the new, you know, first of that line or whatever the case is. Like, you are now the preeminent family of the Alterac, right? Like, that's
remember the last time they tried that again, it was Deathwing.
Of course. I'm not saying that it was good. I'm saying that I could see them trying to do something like that again. But we'll see what happens going into the future. I think that this is something we are going to actually start to see more of. And I think mostly because of what Matt said, and something that I've been thinking about a lot, is how do you reconcile these starting zones for these races now that things have progressed forward story-wise? And we always knew that this was going to be something that happened, especially after the major events of Battle for Azeroth, after Tel'Drossel burning, after Undercity going away, and Bryl sort of like now being up in the air. How is that all going to work out? How is that going to play out? How's that story going to be? We're going to find out more about that, I think, coming into the future. And I think there will be something that deals directly with that. I don't think it'll be up front in Shadowlands. I think it's going to be something we catch maybe at the end of it, and maybe leads into sort of the aftermath of Shadowlands. Because again, going back to something we talked about before, we know that there's going to be erratic time jumps in Shadowlands while we're there. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, like, our key NPCs are all going to be going there. That doesn't mean, like, Anduin's going to be jumping through the portal. He's got other things he's got to deal with here on this plane of existence that he's probably not going to be worried about going into the Shadowlands. He's going to leave that probably to the heroes. And so what happens during that time frame, what happens during, you know, if it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years while we're over there, we don't know how long it's going to be. We know that there's going to be some time screwery going around. But what happens in that time frame? Because the world will change, or should change, while we're dealing with the other things. But it's a good question. We will see what happens. Hopefully, we get something about that in the future. But Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Again, if you have questions for the podcast, be sure to send them in. You can send them to podcast@BlizzardWatch.com, and that can be for either show. Hit us up on Discord in our questions channel, or our patrons only Q and podcast questions channel. Let us know, and we have some exciting things coming up in the very near future for you, going along with those themes that you've been sending in. So thank you very much for that, and we will see you next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.